a big cupboard that we have. We go back a long time in history, that we have the Mishpachas Rabbi Wallerstein, and I wouldn't call it and his gang, but all the Rabbeim, the Choshev Rabbeim with him. I just want to say one thing, that besides being a Mokum Torah, there's a Muridika Mishiris Nefesh that they do over there in Oy Yitzchok, that if Chas V'Sholom, any Bocha doesn't want to stay in learning Kol Yomov and Nebuch, he has to be from the Klol of Bezeis HaPecho Toich HaLechem, so Baruch Hashem, there's a Mokum Torah in New York, a small little section on East 15th, that from there shines forth Torah, even though within the Tumah of America and within the Tumah of Golus, there's a Mokim that's Mechazek and keeps a Kesha and reminds you that there's a Ribbono Shel Olam. And there's a Baruch Hashem, I was Zeicha Taka to hear one Wednesday night, the official was a Welts Talmud Chochem. I don't have to give an introduction who he is and what he is. I'm sure half you have heard him before. And for us, it's a Moridik Zchus to have him to speak, the official.
Just the Rosh Yeshiva, Mar the Asra, Rosh Yeshiva of Ar Yitzchak, and the rest of the gang. Talking about gangs, there was a person who once came up to Shemayim. You got to realize these people are following me around and they're listening to the same jokes for the last 3 days. Okay? Which is really one of the reasons I was masking to come on this trip, is to get even with them for all the things they've did to me. And just joking. That joke I never said, right? Yeah. So anyway, this guy comes up to Shemayim. This guy comes up to Shemayim first, and the Bezen Shemayla says, easy pass. We're letting you right in. We are letting you right in. No din v'cheshbon. What you did was so awesome. Was so... Another guy that said, there's two people sitting in prison that keep repeating the same jokes again and again and again. So finally they were so sick of listening to the same joke, they just gave it numbers. You know that one? The old one? They just gave it numbers. They said number 40, everyone laughed. Number 30, everyone laughed. Number 22, everyone laughed. One guy gets up, number 28, everyone goes, nah. He says, what's wrong with that joke? This is the way you say it. I can't explain it. It's just... In any event, so this guy... Yes, easy pass, sorry. It's been a long day. So he gets easy pass. No, that's it. No din v'cheshbon. They say, no din v'cheshbon? What do you mean no din v'cheshbon? How could that be no din v'cheshbon? He did something so gewaldic that we're letting him right through. All right? So they're about to bring him in, and the malachim say, we've never seen anything like that. He said, what is this? What did you do? He says, I'll tell you. He says, on the Palisades Parkway, driving north. It was north, right? I was on the Palisades Parkway driving north. I was once by a... I met someone in Kiryasoil. I was on the way up from the country to... I'm terrible with directions. Which is a good thing that I'm not driving, because we would be in Saudi Arabia now. But I was coming from the country up to the country. No, let's try this again. It's coming from the city up to the country. So we stopped off in Kiryasoil, which is a long way. And I asked a friend of mine directions, how do you go up further up? So he told me... here and there, right, left, get to the thruway, but remember to go thruway north, okay? Because south takes you back to the city. Thruway north. Three times he told me north. I said, it's getting embarrassing. I said, I know, but I know you. North. Anyway, I did make it to the country that night. The next morning, though, I had a bris in the city. So I came in the next morning, and I'm walking on the block, and I meet him. And he goes, I told you north! I said, I didn't. I went. Anyway, he's driving north of the Palisades Parkway, and he turns around. He's on the medium. And he sees this Yeshiva Bacha standing there, and he's fixing a tire, and he's surrounded by this unbelievable gang. He is surrounded by this gang of real mean dudes. And he just gets out of his car, he runs over to the toughest, biggest guy, huge bulging muscles, leather jacket, sleeveless leather jacket, long ponytail, all sorts of nasty tattoos, grabs him by his ponytail, yanks him off his motorcycle, and he says,
You want to mess? Mess with me!
He tells the Yeshiva Bacha to run. And the Malachim said, that's amazing. He said, that's awesome. That's amazing. How did you do that? And he said, I just had the courage to do it. No wonder they're letting you straight in. Another Malach says, did you think you would ever have the courage to do it? He says, I don't know. Another Malach says, when did it happen? He says, about a minute ago, he said. The emes is that real life's heroes aren't necessarily the ones that rescue people. The real life hero is someone who has the courage to be in a rotten mood and to overcome it. Someone who has the courage that wants to complain, who wants to throw in the towel, and he says, no, I'm going to wait this out. In Shemayim, that is reckoned with a lot more. Somebody once came to Rav Baruch Ber, and he asked him, Atu Bachrim for a Shidduch. So Rav Baruch Ber said, what do you know about the Bachrim? He said, one guy was walking on a bridge, and he saw a woman going with a carriage, and a gust of wind came, and she lost control of the carriage, flipped over the bridge with the baby. This guy jumped over the bridge, into the water, swam, I don't know, 3 miles, caught the baby, brought her back into the mother's lap. What do you know about the other kid? Nothing as dramatic. I do know, though, that there's an almana, an old almana, that lives on the corner of his yeshiva, and every morning he knocks on her door and he asks, you need anything from the store? So Baruch Ba said, I have nothing against the first one, but if these are the only two pieces of information I had, I'd go with the second one. He said, why? He said, because the first one doesn't really tell you anything. For a person to see a baby flying over the bridge and not to run after the baby, so he would have to be very cold-hearted or really, really chicken. Most people would. But basically, he had no p'chira. Most normal people don't have a p'chira. You see a baby falling, you run after the baby. But no one forced him to have to go knock on the door. Because no one forced him to have to go knock on the door, that really tells you who his character is. Really, in Shemayim, what's much more appreciated is the everyday life. You know, they view things very differently than we do. I once parked in front of a parking meter, fire hydrant, for a couple of minutes, just ran into the store, came out, and there was one of the Malachi Chaval over there giving me a ticket. So I took it, and I said, okay, it was Meshed Rosh Hashanah, what can you do? And I take it, and I breathe a sigh of relief, because I see that she got the address totally wrong. This was on 14th Avenue. It was in front of Pinter's Foreign Store. It was on 14th Avenue. The store goes back many years, between 44th Street and 45th Street. And she wrote 7910 14th Avenue. So it's 7910, if you know anything about Borough Park, it's 79 is 79th Street. So how would it be 7910? So somebody passes by and he sees me looking at the ticket. I'm just saying, where did she get 7910 from? So he looks up and he says, now you see what it says on the store? It says cipher. Think about the word cipher, and if you think it's numbers, read it backwards. What does it sound like? I said, right, 7910. You think of the word samach vav fei resh backwards. So I said, isn't it amazing how we can read one thing, and in reality we're so sure what it is, and it's something else in Shemayim. In Shemayim, the real heroes are going to be the ones that have the courage and the ones that have the guts to take on difficult situations. There was a Yidin Yerushalayim, Reb David Biderman, Lelavarebbe, and he had one motto in his life. You're embarrassed? Take advantage of the moment. You're hurt? You're so humiliated you want to scream and yell and run for the hills? Or worse, pick up a chair and throw it at the guy? Don't be a fool. Take advantage of that emotion. There were two people that worked in the Gemach, and it was pretty heavy, especially in those days where people were dying of hunger, literally on the streets. There was one Yid, his name was Gavriel, and Gavriel hadn't got into a fight with somebody else about money in the Gemach, and this other guy, Moshe, went after Gavriel whenever he saw him on the street. He said, Duratzeach, Luganev! And he couldn't take it anymore. Couldn't take it anymore. Really bothered him to no end. And he asked permission to answer him back. So he told him, know what it says and someone that doesn't answer back? It says, V'aleim ha'kasev oimer k'tseis ha'shemesh b'gvirasai. You're like the emerging sun, k'tseis ha'shemesh b'gvirasai. He says, what do I get out of being the sun? He's embarrassing me. I don't need the sun. You know, somebody once came to a chacham and he said, I don't have parnassus. So he said, I'm giving you a benched $1 bill. He says, maybe you got a cursed $100 bill? He says, what do I get out of being the sun? Trust me. If Chazal say, k'tseis ha'shemesh b'gvirasai, it's a good thing. Don't answer back. Don't answer back. He never did. But the Hiyayim, this Yid, Gavriel, got into a real debt, and he had to go to, he went at that point to Vienna to collect money. And he was in trouble. He was really in trouble. And he was only scared that this Moish back at the Gemach is going to take advantage of his vacuum and cause him problems. He's walking in Vienna, he walks into the bathroom, and he finds a loot of cash, tremendous amount of money. He asks around, it had no siman, it was, he considered it was Rosh Hashanah. I don't know if he was right or wrong, but Lamaisa, he considered the money his. And he's walking on the street, and at a random checkpoint, the police check him, and they find a wad of cash. They say, what's this? So what's he going to say? Found the money in the bathroom? Every Ghana says that. So in desperation, he said that he's, you know, what do you mean, why I have cash? Yeah, where do you have so much cash from? He says, I'm the famous Seicher of Yerushalayim. I'm the famous businessman of Yerushalayim. So yeah, they call in an old maskal that speaks Yiddish. He says, where do you work? He says, in the Gemach office here and there. So we'll check you out if you're the famous Seicher of Yerushalayim. And he goes, oh no. And they call the Gemach. And who picks up the phone? His good friend Moshe. And he hears this guy talking in Yiddish. And he says, I want to know about so-and-so. What's his situation? Now, this guy figured he must be by a gevir, and the gevir wants to know if he's really poor or not. So he says, I'm going to fix his wagon. He says, you want to know his situation? He's the most famous seicher in all of Yerushalayim! I says, thanks. Hey, you're off the hook. He comes back to the Gemach. He tells Moshe, thanks for saving my life. He says, I saved your life. I buried you. No, you didn't. And he tells him the story, and this Moshe was ripping the hair out of his head. He said, I tried to bury you. He said, you tried to bury me. So he went back to the Lel of the Rebbe, so he told him, now you know what Chazal knew when they say, Ketzeis HaShemesh V'Gurasai? The sun is never late. The sun is always on time, right? Except for Yeshua, 3 hours. There are pivotal points in our life that could either destroy us or give us life. He could have wound up in jail the rest of his life, instead he was rich the rest of his life. It all depended on the right person. Now it turned out later that this Moshe was not even supposed to be in the Gemach office at that moment, but he left something and walked in when the telegram came or the phone rang or whatever it was. So God put this appointment together. These two people had to be, it had to be synchronized to the second in order to save his life. What happens is, if you're in a mood of yelling and screaming and destroying, and instead of yelling and seeing and destroying, you turn things around so that Rebbeinu Shem says the sun is on your side. Now, the emes is, the staff of our Yitzhak that's here, these are people that are Moser Nefesh themselves, 24/7, and many more that there's only so many people that fit on the plane. But there's a staff of rebbeim that literally give up their lives for the Talmidim. I just pop in once a week. I do nothing. Okay? But I can tell you from my limited nothing that I have seen kids go from being someone that I would have literally, I say this literally, would have been petrified to be on the same street as them. And I would tell you, lucky is the person that gets them as a son-in-law. And I think that what happens is that sometimes when you hit hard times and you're guided right, and you're guided right, and you're willing to subject yourself to people that really care for you, so all of a sudden the Rebbeinu Shem says, hey, that's a lot of pent-up emotion. That's a lot of power. And you got easy pass. And you don't have to go through a lot of the din v'chesbin in ordinary life that a person has to go to success. The emotion pulls you up. Pulls you up. There was a guy, I read it in the Pearl Harbor day, so I just was reading one of my kids' current events thing, so always look for excuses why I'm reading the newspaper. But this guy was a 17-year-old kid. He joined the Navy because they had no food in his house. And he was on one of the ships where the Japanese hit. He was on a Navy ship, a Navy hospital ship. And what he did was, he describes what it was like. He was ferrying people back and forth from the ship, digging bodies out of the water. Describes digging heads out of the water, digging feet out of the water, sometimes whole bodies. And he describes what these bodies looked like. They were soaked in oil because the huge aircraft carriers, the tanks exploded. And you can only see black, and the only thing you saw was their eyes. And they were literally burning to death. And he said he spent the entire night trying to save lives, schlepping just bodies out into this Navy hospital ship. He said right after he got out of the Army, he began to have terrible nightmares. He began to have such terrible nightmares that he couldn't deal with it anymore, could not deal with it anymore. To the point where he was talking about taking his life. And somebody said something to him, so he writes. He says, how come you didn't have those nightmares while you were ferrying people back and forth? Why didn't you just collapse right there and then? He said, I couldn't. I was too busy saving lives. So then why don't you commit the rest of your life to save lives? So he joined the volunteer fire department, and he worked his way up, and he spent the rest of his life in volunteer, and became an expert in traumatic and dangerous situations, and he flies from country to country, he became a consultant. He said, that guy saved my life. Because it's easy to tell a person, hey, don't be in a rotten mood. I am in a rotten mood, and I am terrified. And this post-trauma distress is going to destroy me. The only thing that's going to save me is for him to take those koichos and to convert it. And we have that power to take those koichos and convert it. This guy walks into a Rebbe. The Rebbe says to him, tell me something. What are you going to do with that? How do you have pronunciation? He says, I have a cow. He says, really? You have a cow? What do you do with the cow? He says, I feed it, and then it gives milk, and I sell the milk. He says, you live on the 15th floor on the projects in Williamsburg. What do you feed it with? He says, I give it milk. It's giving milk. He says, how much milk does it drink? It drinks 30 gallons of milk a week. Well, how much milk does it give? About 20. So explain to me why you feed your cow 30 gallons of milk and you get 20, and how exactly do you have parnassa? So he answers, Rebbe, I buy the milk at ShopRite, $1.69 a gallon. Comes out Chol Yisrael, I sell it $2.59 a gallon. What do you mean, how I make parnassa? There are situations in life where there's easy pass, where something, all of the pent-up anger and all of the pent-up hurt and all of the pent-up frustration is converted to bracha. And when it's converted to bracha, it changes. I said this story once in Beis Yaakov, and Rebbetzin Kalmanovich came over to me, and she said, I will tell you an actual story that happened to one of my students. This kid was in a terrible fire, and she came out terribly, her face was terribly distorted, despite a series of plastic surgeries and skin grafts, her face still looked terribly distorted. And she got into a fight with a kid, she's 15 or 16 years old, and the kid made some nasty remark about the scars on her face. And she came back, she threw herself into her bed, and she burst into tears. And she says she's never again going to walk the street. And her mother came in, and her mother says, I'm going to that school, I'm going to speak to the principal, I'm going to have that kid thrown out. And her grandmother came in and listened to the situation. And her grandmother sat down to her, and her grandmother said, what are you going to get at throwing the girl? She says, Zaynish Kantipish, she said, use those tears and daven for a good shidduch. Because it's going to be a problem when it comes to a shidduch. You're going to need someone that's going to look away at this. So use those tears and convert it from anger to tefillah. She told me that 3 years later she got this most unbelievable shidduch. And they said to the boy, it doesn't bother you? He said, no. Somehow he just sees around it. And his mother once said to the girl, being that she is a mother-in-law, I understand why it didn't bother my son. What a genius, sensitive remark. And she answered, 3 years ago I took care of it. 3 years ago I took care of it, and when someone humiliates me, I learn how to convert that into bracha. She got a good shidduch, and she also gave her mother-in-law the message not to make another comment to humiliate her again, along the lines. But this is something that we run into. There's a story in the Sefer Leinu L'Shabeach where a young man in Yerushalayim had a sick kid, and doctor said, no yish l'chayel, there's no chance. No chance. There's absolutely nothing we can do for her. I cannot help you. He was trying to get through to a doctor in America. He had no insurance. He had no nothing. He had absolutely nothing. And he went and traveled back and forth. And he got through to this Askin in Bnei Brak. And this Askin said to him that he's going to be on the phone with a certain doctor. Then he heard that doctor's in Israel. And maybe you can, if you're here at a certain time, and he's here, maybe we can do something. And he kept calling, is he here? Finally he told him, you have a half hour to make it from Yerushalayim to Bnei Brak. He's going to be here then. Guy runs out, flags down a taxi, jumps in. He says, I got to be in this and this address in Bnei Brak in a half an hour. He says, hey, Efshar. Takes out 600 shkolim, and it becomes Efshar. And he says, this taxi is like racing, as in general, what they say about Israeli taxis. They don't drive too fast. They fly too slow, they're too low. And he's racing in and out through farms and through everything, and everyone else on the road is running for their lives, and he screeches to a stop, all four wheels flat, burning, the engine pops up, overheating, jumps out, races up the stairs, bangs on the door. The guy says, oh, I've got to tell you, the doctor canceled, he'll show up today. And this guy's like, he's about to faint. And he asks for a glass of water. And as he's about to drink the water, he starts saying, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehiyeh Bedvarei. And he's about to say the words, Baruch Atah Hashem, and suddenly the thought occurs to him. He says, Ribono Shel Olam, you're so great, you're so kind, no appointments, I don't need protection to get to you. Whenever you want, you can open the city, you can daven. Whenever you want, you can do it. He says, Akapora midala eskonem. And he yells at the top of his lungs, Rabbi Shalom, you help me. But then there's a crowd around him, and they say, trying to figure out who they should call. And he just drinks the water, and he goes down and travels back to Yerushalayim. His wife looks at him, he's a mess. And he says, things are going to be okay. And over the next couple of months, there was a tremendous turn for the better, to the point where his daughter didn't need the treatment. And he told everyone, you know what did it? A shahakal. His wife said, a shahakal, that's what did it? You couldn't make a shahakal here in a bag of potato chips. You had to spend 600 shkolim and scare the living daylights and have a 1,500 drivers on the road. He said, there's no way in the world I could have made that shahakal over here. There's like once in a while a shahakal in your life that you're going to make that's rough and tough. And it's going to be at the moment that you want to give up. It's going to be at the moment where you have every reason in the world to believe it's not going to happen. And that's the moment that you have to do it. And when you make that shahakal, you can be like some of those kids that I saw in our Yitzchak, and I'm sure that anyone, your Rosh Hashiva will tell you, and anyone has the experience that they've seen that also. I've seen kids shoot up from level Z to be the envy of anybody who has any shaykhs with them, sayin Torah, sayin avoida, because somebody caught them and made that conversion. Took the pain in their heart and said, don't waste it. Convert it into bracha. There was an man in my shul, his name was Reb Shmuel Beinish. Zecher Tzadik L'vracha. Shmuel is a very interesting fellow. He would always tell me jokes about the war. If you know him, you'd realize it could be. He once told me that the Nazis used to call people out in the middle of the night. They would line them up, and there was a big map. He would schlep one guy over, and he would say to him, where are you from? The guy would say, Radomsk. He would say, Radomsk, where is it on the map? He'd pull him over, show it to him on the map, and the Nazi would make a red circle around it, and he would say, just for your information, I want you to know that Radomsk is Judenrein. Do you understand that? So if you think, if you have any wild dream that somehow your wife and sons and daughters are alive, they're dead. And the guy would walk back broken and cry. Every night somebody else got the call for this torture. Then it came Reb Shmuel's turn. And people begged him, please, no smart comments, okay? This isn't your 8th grade Rebbe. Make a smart comment, it could kill all of us. Just. But Reb Shmuel was Reb Shmuel. And the Nazi said to him, where do you live? And his answer was, I live in a town called Misa Mishuna. Everyone goes, that's it. They're going to mow us all down now tonight. And the German says to him, Misa Mishuna, where is that? And Shmuel steps, well, he's looking for it on the map, and they're looking for it together. And everyone's going, no, this can't be true. And he says, where is this Misa Mishuna? And they say, I don't know, someplace between, it's supposed to be between Sosnitz and Radomsk, I don't know where. He says, you better update these maps, you know. Finally, the Nazi rips the map off the wall, throws it on the floor. He grabs Reb Shmuel, throws him up against the pole, and he says to him, I don't know if we got this town of Misa Mishuna yet, but I want to promise you, if we didn't get Misa Mishuna yet, we're going to get it. Do you understand that? He said he understood. The other story of Shmuel told me many years later was that he was once, was the death marches after the war. And the Nazis saw that it was only a matter of days before the liberating armies, it was just a question of who gets the first, the Russians, the English, or the Americans. And instead of just running for their lives or doing their best to try to save their own soldiers that were being killed at the battlefront, they had everyone march, day in, day out. The sun would beat down on them mercilessly. People fell to the floor. They were dying of thirst. They would run along the water, people would jump into the water to try to drink, and the Nazis would shoot them, saying, we have to do that because we want to make sure they don't drown. You see, we're doing it for your own good. That he told me was their joke. They were marching, and at one point, as people were dropping like flies, they were upset that they were not the ones that got to pick between life and death. So they made each person carry another person. He said they actually made him carry someone else. And his whole modus operandi was, look, they can take my life. I have no right to take it. And I'm not going to give up. I'm just going to keep walking. I'll make it another 10 meters. And he just kept walking, as if he was commanding his feet to go on. Finally, after 2 days of marching like this, they were all pushed into a barn, and the doors were bolted. Now, they had heard this before, and it unfortunately was true in Gargalegen and many other places. Eisenhower wrote that it was one of the worst sights he had ever seen in his whole life, and he had seen some pretty dramatic sights. They locked the barn in, they pushed in the people, and they surrounded it with hay and lit the barn ablaze. And there were rumors this was going to happen. And there was no water, and the people were tired, and it was a hot day, and there was no room to breathe. And he climbed out of a window. He didn't think he was going to escape. But the thought occurred to him that this may be his last night on this world, so therefore he wants to daven Maariv. So let me daven Maariv. Let me daven Maariv. And he starts davening. And the capos, which were the Jewish police, who had some special treatment from the Germans and believed that if they would do the job for the Germans, that they would have it better. Of course, we can't judge because we don't know. They surrounded him. And as they surrounded him, they aimed. They said, what are you doing here? He says, I want to daven Maariv, and I'm going back in. He said, daven inside. He says, I can't. The stench is too bad. And he started to daven. And they surrounded him, and they started to do like this jig. And they were singing, ah, Morgan Gatman of Brennan has davened to Maariv. Tomorrow they're going to burn him. Today's davening Maariv. Tomorrow they're going to burn him. Today's davening Maariv. Tomorrow they're going to burn him. Today's davening. They were like singing this chant. And he said, really, for the first time, even he was overwhelmed with a terrible sense of foreboding and depression. And then he said, let me hear what, they're saying. He said, Chagazach Tzizich Alein. Shmiel the Hess was a Zung. Morgen Gatman of Brennan. Tomorrow they're going to burn me. You know what that means? It means today I'm still alive. And if I didn't look at this world only as a matter of today, I could have never made it till now. So he said, today I still have a chance to daven Maariv. And it was like a game. They were singing this song louder and louder, tomorrow you're going to burn me. And he started davening louder and louder. And he said, I won. I daven Maariv. I was pretty sure it was the last Maariv of my life, and I was pretty sure it was the last Shmoneh Esrei of my life. And I finished, and I walked in, and I walked past their smirking faces. Of course, he did not share with his friends the confirmation of their suspicions that indeed that's what the Germans intended to do. And about an hour later, he heard gunshots outside. Everyone fell to the floor, though it wasn't possible because there were so many people crammed. People were frightened and screaming, and suddenly there was this deathly silence. There was like this loud silence. And one person couldn't take it anymore. He burst open one of the windows and climbed out. He couldn't figure out what was happening. But he had a sense the danger was over. The doors were opened. Everyone came out. Apparently they could see on the road in the distance the Russian tanks moving down. So they knew that the SS saw that and they had no chance to light the fire. He turned around and walked back to the place where he davened Maariv and he saw dead bodies on the floor. They were the bullet-ridden bodies of these capos. And he realized right there and then that the Russians understood that the capos would have more information about who the SS people are than anyone else because they dealt with them on a one-to-one basis. The problem was that the SS people also knew that the capos had more information on them than anyone else, and they wanted to run and hide. So therefore, instead of burning the people down, they figured they'll first save their own skin, and they shot the capos. All the people that said tomorrow Gatman of Rebbeinu were lying dead at his feet. When he told me the story, this man went through a lot in his life, an awful lot. Awful, awful lot. He was an old man, and he was sick, and he said to me, you know, every time in my life I wanted to get depressed, I would say to myself, Shmuel, how many tomorrows passed since that day they said tomorrow they're going to burn you? 50 years of tomorrows! Imagine if I wouldn't have davened that Maariv. I want to tell you something. I really believe in the bottom of my heart that the reason all those people were saved is because he had the guts to daven Maariv. If we had the guts to daven that one Maariv, that one tefillah, that one block tomorrow, make that move, when you feel in your heart you want to throw in the towel, just who knows how many people amongst ourselves we can save and how much easy pass would be available to all of us.